Okay, guy three, if you were to describe yourself as a coffee, what drink would you be?
I'd say an oat milk latte on ice.
Too
Complex yet
early.
simple. I know it is. I know. But it's also what I make and I order like all the time, and it's so good. So that's mine. What about you, Shelby?
First, we need to get oat milk latte into you. So,
Oh my
you're awake for this podcast.
God, yeah. It's an important one. I need to wake up.
Okay, I guess for me, my go-to coffee has always been a blonde misto with caramel. I think it kind of remember resembles. Okay,
You
I
need the
need a
coffee
blonde
now.
misto. Karma. So, it resembles my bold and strong personality, but I think when you start sipping, it gets sweeter like me. Yeah, not trying to sound cocky, but I can be sweet.
You can be sweet. Okay, welcome everyone to Coffee and Steam podcast, where we choose scientific accessibility over jargon.
And coffee over all other beverages.
So grab your cup of coffee or a beverage of your preference. We won't be offended if it's not coffee, and get ready for some steam. We're extremely excited to launch this podcast and even more excited to welcome a very special guest, Dr. Divya Jagatheesan, who recently completed her PhD at the University of Toronto at the Institute of Medical Sciences, researching neonatal or newborn health. Congratulations.
Thank you, Guy Three and Shalini. I'm happy to be here. I'm very excited to drink my tea along with your coffee and talk about my PhD.
Okay, so I guess you kind of answered the question we were going to ask you. That's okay. But I mean, before we dive into the hardcore science, we do have a burning question. As you know, we are both obsessed with coffee, and Guy Through here is a major coffee connoisseur. So we would love to know, I guess, now if you were to describe yourself as a tea, what would it be?
I think I would describe myself as an Earl Grey tea, so it has caffeine in it. But recently I switched to like chamomile tea in the morning because during my PhD, I think I was off the wire caffeine high. So I was like trying to be zen and more calm. So I've transferred to Peach Tranquility from Starbucks.
Wow, so you're not a typical grad student just, drinking their extra large cup of coffee the whole
No,
day.
I tried to drink coffee because I thought it was something I was supposed to do, and like made me sick. So I was like, I'm just gonna stick to my tea.
Nice. Maybe I should try switching to tea.
My gosh, yes. We're always so buzzed, right?
So I guess now the burning question's out of the way. Let's dive into the fun stuff. So first off, Divya, why don't you tell us about yourself and, what has inspired your research journey?
Sure. So I actually started research when I was all the way in first year undergrad, the first year of my summer, and I did a chart review for a rare condition called small vessel CNS vasculitis. And like most undergrad students, I did that because I'm like, you're supposed to do research if you want to go to med school. So I did it with that intention, but didn't really understand what research was. But when I did do that research job, I met this amazing pediatric rheumatologist who showed me how research could save lives. So this is a rare condition, small vessel CNS vasculitis. And this rheumatologist, Dr. Susanna Bensler, was one of the very few people to diagnose, to figure out how to diagnose it. And prior to some of her papers that's come out and some of the research that her and her team had done, you weren't able to diagnose this condition until basically like in an autopsy. So it really showed me how her research and patients that come to her to see her, because of her research directly, the research that she does, it like saved lives. So that's what kind of spiked my interest in research. And so I just started continuing working at SickKids in different fields, from like pediatric neurology to cancer to developmental disabilities. And then my passion for loving to travel to go to conferences motivated me to kind of work on getting abstract submissions done. And then eventually I started working as a research coordinator. And once I got enough research experience under my belt, I felt like it was I was ready to do my own research. So I started my PhD. And again, I met an amazing mentor again who really advocated for me. And I think the key is I was blessed with incredible mentors from the start and people that advocated for me, which is especially important for a second generation woman of color to help launch your career and find a space in like academia.
Mm-hmm. That's for so sure. Important. Especially in, yeah, fields like academia, being in a good environment where you can really feed off of others. It's really mm-hmm. great. It's great for potential. And for our listeners out there, I actually previously worked with Vivi on her research project and found her work so interesting and exciting. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your research, and what you did, and what you worked on regarding the health of newborns.
Sure. So my research focuses on neonatal hyperbilirubinemia, and another word for that is jaundice or liver disease. So typically clinicians screen for neonatal hyperbilirubinemia as early as 24 hours of age, and they do this by measuring the amount of bilirubin in a baby. So usually the bilirubin is cleared by the liver, but among some infants, it may not be cleared that easily and requires continued monitoring and treatment. If the bilirubin level is too high, the unbound part of the bilirubin can pass through the blood-brain barrier and then cause neurological deficits. So many infants born early are at higher risk of this, so clinicians monitor them more closely. So my research looked at how their bilirubin is measured and ways we could potentially rethink the current methods of how we're measuring bilirubin and monitoring these preterm infants.
That's quite interesting. So when bilirubin, it crosses the blood-brain barrier, and I guess for individuals who don't know, you can think of the blood-brain barrier as like a fence that protects the brain essentially. Is it quite like detrimental, or you know, if it does cross the blood-brain barrier, can the effects be reversed?
So from my understanding, I don't think that it could be reversed once it's crossed the blood-brain barrier. So when it with bilirubin, once it crosses the blood-brain barrier, it deposits into specific parts of the brain. So it's called the basal ganglia is one of the main issues. So it usually impacts like hearing loss is one of the issues. Some infants might get dystonic cerebral palsy. So there's some neurodevelopmental disorders. So it is detrimental effects once it does cross the blood-brain barrier. So we do everything we can to make sure that it doesn't. And the incidence of the technical term for this is kernicterus. And that is very rare in now because of increased monitoring and increased treatment. But that's why we monitor it so closely.
Wow. So I guess that kind of explains the importance of this research so it doesn't essentially get to that like detrimental level.
Yes.
So now, as you may know, you know, the goal of our podcast is to, you know, help our audience learn about research occurring in real time in a way that's, you know, understandable for those who might not come from STEM backgrounds. So we want to help break down your research and explain its importance to our audience. So to begin off, could you tell us like what exactly is bilirubin and why is it so important to be tested?
Yeah, sure. So bilirubin is actually a byproduct of hemoglobin breakdown, like catabolism. So usually when a baby is born, the red blood cells break down quicker than adults and at a faster rate. And there's a delay in when the liver function kicks in. But this is normal, and usually once the liver kicks in and the red blood cells break down, it like everything's fine. Mm-hmm. And then the importance of monitoring this continuously, like I said, is if there's too much bilirubin in your blood, the unbound part of bilirubin can cross through the blood-brain barrier and cause neurological death. So the main purpose is to keep your bilirubin at a healthy level, because having bilirubin in your body is normal and you should have it, but making sure it's not too much in your body.
As you previously mentioned, your research focuses on providing a little bit more insight about bilirubin and what bilirubin is in terms of its function, so experts can better determine how to assess and manage the increase of bilirubin in infants. My question for you is, how did you go about testing for this, or what sort of information, in your opinion, would be useful for experts or something that people can look out for?
So what you do is you do a test, a blood test for bilirubin as early as 24 to 72 hours of age. And then that level is then compared to a nomogram that was developed. So nomogram is basically a graph of the norm, what's considered the normal levels and safe levels of bilirubin. So you take that level that you have, compare it to the nomogram, and if it's below the nomogram, then you don't have to do anything. But if it's above whatever is the normal value, then you start treatment or continued monitoring. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, and then you, what the treatment is phototherapy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I don't know this is a highly complicated question, but how does phototherapy or like light therapy essentially reduce the bili levels?
So when the baby's under light therapy, it changes the isomerization of the bilirubin and makes it easier for it to so facilitates the clearance of it, so it gets rid of it faster.
Okay.
Oh, what does isomerization mean for, you know, all of us who don't really know what isomerization is?
So, you know, isomerization is when kind of the molecule changes its orientation. So I think in the context of here, the orientation of bilirubin is essentially being modified, so it's able to clear out faster.
Cool. Thanks, Shali.
Yeah, you know, Orgo did me some good. So that all sounds amazing, and you know, I'm sure that, you know, your research will make a positive impact, or it already has made a positive impact on infant health. So, you know, aside from your research on infant health, I know you have recently started to conduct more research on how COVID-19 has impacted the Tamil community in the GTA. Could you tell us a little bit more about this research?
Yeah, great. So me, myself, and a couple of, community sort of researchers, and there's a mental health worker and counselors. Also, we're all friends. And so we started this group called Interdisciplinary Perspectives in Health Research. And so we talked about how our parents are often frontline workers, and they had worked during the pandemic, and we really wanted to describe their experiences and describe the Tamil community's experience, because a lot of the Tamil community we suspect are also frontline workers. So that's why we launched a survey to gather information about their experiences, and in hopes of advocating for things like paid sick days, better supports for frontline workers through the research that we're doing in the Tamil community, and contribute to a greater body of knowledge where everyone else is sort of talking about their own experience as frontline workers as well.
Okay, wow, that's amazing. I do know that even in my family and people that I've been speaking to on the day today, a lot of people are still concerned, even in a couple of months into the pandemic, almost a whole year, kind of when everything's getting back into it, back into the flow of things, back to work. So with this information, what do you plan on presenting with the research that you find?
So I think eventually we'll have to look at what the results are, and hopefully we can report, because there's a kind of a push for more research in people of color's experience with COVID-19. So we want to just contribute to that body of knowledge, and also come up with ways that we can advocate better for paid sick days, and advocate better for frontline workers in future pandemics potentially.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any resources or anything that maybe anyone listening could look out for, reach out to, or?
None yet, but we'll keep in touch if there's anything comes out. We're still very early in the stages of this.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, if we get any of this information, we will start sharing it on our Coffee and Steam feeds as well. So keep an eye out, listeners, if you ever want to look into anything that's been brought up. So moving on from all the research side of things, clinical research is something that you're really heavily involved in. Very much so different. I know Shalini can attest to this from maybe a molecular side of things, and research is such a diverse field. So what is some advice you might want to provide to students or people who are interested in looking into the field of clinical research, or who want to get to know what clinical research is?
I would say in undergrad, get as much clinical research as possible and get involved in more of the prospective research. So prospective means like studies that are following kids, like that are in person, following kids. It doesn't necessarily have to be in person because things are virtual now, but, you know, following participants and over a certain period of time. And kind of every time you get a research experience, so if you start with, say, a chart review, and that's your data entry first job, always see if you can get more research experience and a different type of research with your next job. Don't kind of settle on one type of research experience, because that will really expose you to figure out, you know, do you like doing chart review studies, or do you like doing qualitative research studies or quantitative? And you won't know that till you actually get that experience. And there's a lot of methodologies in clinical research that are all equally as important. So I think just learning about every single experience, and then you can kind of decide on, okay, what area of research do I like and do I do well in?
What sort of, I guess kind of like, what sort of roles and essentially should a individual like looking for a research position look out for? So like, you know, for example, in like molecular research, I always tell like my students, oh, figure out, you know, kind of what techniques you want to learn and then go from there, because not all labs use, you know, the same techniques and things like that. So
here I think in sort of clinical research, you the first step is a research assistant. So you can do anything from, the main thing from research assistant is learning how to consent and recruit. So talking to patients and or participants, consenting them, explaining the study, and then recruiting them. So it's kind of this like process. So first you learn to consent and recruit if you're doing that. And then the next step is collecting data. So administering surveys. If you're interested in qualitative research or learning that skills, that's a really important skill in terms of learning how to interview properly, getting information and those methods. So there's just like a wealth of information. So I would say just getting experience in any of those. So research assistant positions that look at their, when the job description says consenting, recruiting, follow-up interviews, data collection, that sort of stuff. And then also if there's chart reviews, and then having a statistical background also helps as well. And that's more of like, you kind of build up to that after you've done the first part of the research, which is collecting the data. And then once you know how the data is collected, then you can get more of the training for stats, which you usually get in school.
Yeah. I have stats anxiety. I hate stats, but it has to be done. Data does not mean anything unless you do stats. Okay, so that hopefully that was, you know, useful to our listeners out there who want to or are interested in, you know, eventually pursuing clinical research. So now to sort of end off our show, we have something called our final brew, which is a few of our last burning questions. And we'd like you to try to answer the first thing that pops into your mind here. So grad school has always had this perception of essentially all school, no play, you know, there's so much like dedication and work involved, late nights and weekends. What would you say is the fun side of grad school?
So the fun side of grad school, I would say, is if you're in a good lab and you get the opportunity, is travel. So whether it be within Canada or outside of Canada, that's one of the things I loved about grad school, is I would submit my abstract for research and like to, you know, conferences, and been able to travel. Like I've been able to travel all across Canada, like Vancouver, Prince Edward Island, Alberta. And then also I've been able to travel in the States. So I went to San Francisco, Baltimore, and this was all because of my grad school, like being in grad school and going to the conferences. Granted, like not all grad students may be able to, but you will get at least one opportunity to meet potentially to travel, at least locally.
You know, that sounds like so much fun. My conference was supposed to be in Vancouver, but thanks to a global pandemic, it was virtual.
Yeah, I know. So things are different now with COVID, but yeah, that was one of the highlights of grad school.
I can imagine an all paid trip.
I know.
Sometimes you do have to dish in, like, but there are, they do, some schools do offer, you know, grants that you can apply to to cover some of your travel.
Yeah.
So seeking those out is important too. They want you to travel to different, like, they want you to present at conferences. So even if it's a local conference in Ontario, I think it's still interesting to do.
For sure. For sure. Mm-hmm. I guess a follow-up is, how did you maintain work-life balance throughout all this?
So I did it.
I did not want to hear that.
No, but you can. So one of the things, like, I still, like, took vacation, I think, once or twice, a couple of times. I think my friend got married, so I did ended up taking 2 weeks off to go to Scotland. It's really hard, but I think it's, you know, just reminding, like, having the problem with grad school is everyone expects you to work around the clock. So it's up to you to decide, okay, after 7 p.m. or 6 p.m., I'm going to stop working. And, like, realizing that if you don't send something at 9 p.m. at night, the world's not going to end. It can wait till 9 a.m. in the morning. Mm-hmm. So I slowly, in the last, like, sort of year or 2 years of my PhD, I started realizing, okay, I need, like, this is taking a toll on my body. I'm feeling burnt out. I need to draw these lines where, you know, I don't need to work till 9 p.m. or answer an email at midnight. Just because my supervisor doesn't do this, but, like, just because, you know, someone happens to send an email around that time. So I think it's just really carving out that time for yourself and developing boundaries and realizing that you don't need to respond to emails or do something late at night.
Yeah, especially because I feel like grad school is like a marathon, like, you're in it for so many years, and you really need to draw those boundaries, and that's something I'm still learning, so hopefully I get there.
Yeah, and I always tell, like, students, it's what you put out. If you respond to emails quickly, which you but you respond to emails, but you respond to emails at 2 a.m. in the morning or 3 a.m. in the morning, you're setting that precedence that this is okay, right? And it's not necessarily okay. You know, you get a great stipend for being a grad student. So you shouldn't be expected to be on call or the same way that, you know, like, someone with a high paying job. It's like, you don't get a very nice stipend. So you should be able to, you know, create boundaries for yourself. And if you don't want to respond on a weekend, then you don't respond on a weekend. And, you know, it's not going to be the end of the world unless there's an actual deadline.
Of course.
Yeah.
So to pull off on that, every scientist, you know, has their own, like, aha moment or many aha moments where they feel like everything that they worked for, everything that they worked hard on, kind of all clicks together. So what would you say your biggest aha moment was?
I think realizing that we need to do more research that's more implementable. And making that research, so even though it sounds negative, it's actually a positive, is that research, it takes a long time to make a clinical change. So, and I learned that through my PhD. So, you know, transitioning to be like, I want to do more research now that is more implementable, that implementation science is basically doing something that'll create a change. That was my aha moment. I don't know if I answered your question.
Oh, no, that's definitely it. Like, that's kind of also what, as STEAM or STEM as a field as a whole, everyone's working hard to kind of produce work or produce information that kind of can be helpful to future generations and things to come. So really, that's such a big realization that I feel like it really puts your work into perspective and kind of puts that whole, like you're saying, like, setting the precedent for yourself, but also, like, dividing up your work. When you love what you do, you do what you love. So it doesn't feel like work, but, you know, setting up that boundary, feeling that realization, that really helps out. That's such a good answer.
Yeah. So I guess the final question of our final brew. So, you know, I've always felt that, you know, with individuals in STEM and research, there's always this, like, stereotype of how we should be, you know, nerdy, braidy, dressed in a particular way, and so on. So we want to help kind of break that stereotype. So what would be the most least, you know, stereotypical scientist thing about you?
So I'm actually very bad at math, like, absolutely terrible. If someone asks me a question like, what's 37 minus 23 or something, I will sit there and I still don't know that answer. I am horrible at that.
I'm telling you, yesterday I had to pull out my fingers to do something.
I was like, I don't know. I don't know my times table very well. So I'm very bad at math and somehow still got a PhD. But so that's, yeah. So we're not all good at everything.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, hey, it's not a PhD in math, right? So you don't need math for exactly. your field.
Exactly. This is basic yeah. math, so it's not acceptable, but I am not very good at math.
No, I totally resonate with that. Like, sometimes when I have to do some like dilution calculation, so simple, but I'm pulling out a calculator and I'm just like, oh, why? I should know this. But yeah.
Oh, fun times. Well, there you have it, everyone. Today, we learned the importance of assessing bilirubin in infants and how it impacts their health. We also had the amazing opportunity to hear about Divya's ongoing research project about how COVID-19 has affected Tamil community and the mental health and things like that. So thank you so much, Divya, for being on our show, for sharing your research. And it was incredibly insightful. And we really hope that our audience learned something new about clinical research, newborn health, and research as a whole.
And so, you know, stay tuned for our next episode that we're brewing up, where we'll come back with some more STEAM content.
Brewing up. We sound like we're witches. We're brewing stuff up.
Wizards. You know, they make potions and stuff. And, you know, the whole reason I went to grad school was because, you know, Hogwarts wasn't hiring. And, you know, I wanted to blow up things in the lab.
That was on your grad cap.
yeah, that was the slogan on my undergrad cap.
Well, everyone, this is Coffee and Steam, where we choose scientific accessibility over jargon and coffee over all other beverages.